We read the Word of God together as we turn to the book of Genesis. Genesis chapter 33, and we read this chapter. Jacob looked up, and there was Esau coming with his 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two maidservants. He put the maidservants and their children in front, Leah and her children next, Rachel and Joseph in the rear. He himself went on ahead and bowed down to the ground seven times as he approached his brother. But Esau ran to meet Jacob and embraced him. He threw his arms around his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Then Esau looked up, saw the women and children. "Who are these with you?" he asked. Jacob answered, "They are the children God has graciously given your servant." Then the maidservants and their children approached and bowed down. Next, Leah and her children came and bowed down. Last of all came Joseph and Rachel. They too bowed down. Esau asked, "What do you mean by all these droves I met?" "To find favor in your eyes, my lord," he said. But Esau said, "I already have plenty, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself." "No, please," said Jacob. "If I have found favor in your eyes, accept this gift from me. For to see your face is like seeing the face of God, now that you have received me favorably. Please accept the present that was brought to you, for God has been gracious to me, and I have all I need." And because Jacob insisted, Esau accepted it. Then Esau said, "Let us be on our way. I'll accompany you." But Jacob said to him, "My lord knows that the children are tender and that I must care for the ewes and cows that are nursing their young. If they are driven hard just one day, all the animals will die. So let my lord go on ahead of his servant while I move along slowly at the pace of the droves before me and that of the children until I come to my lord in Seir." Esau said, "Then let me leave some of my men with you." "But why do that?" Jacob asked. "Just let me find favor in the eyes of my lord." So that day Esau started on his way back to Seir. Jacob, however, went to Succoth, where he built a place for himself and made shelters for his livestock. That's why the place is called Succoth. After Jacob came from Paddan Aram, he arrived safely at the city of Shechem in Canaan, camped within sight of the city. For 100 pieces of silver he bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, the plot of ground where he pitched his tent. There he set up an altar and called it El Elohe Israel. The times when we enjoy particularly close fellowship with the Lord are very precious. I trust you do experience those from time to time. And they should be treasured. They are a gift from God. Times when we are perhaps especially conscious of His working graciously in our lives. But those special times are not given in order to provide an escape from everyday reality. We'd like to stay, as it were, on the mountaintop. And yet, it isn't God's purpose for us. You think even of the disciples of the Lord Jesus, Matthew 17, when they witnessed the transfiguration, an experience, I'm sure, that marked them for the rest of their lives. They saw wonderful things, and they would have wanted to stay there, and yet they couldn't. God's purpose, they had to come down the mountain, and there, waiting at the bottom, was the challenge of the demon-possessed boy. However much we might like to stay on mountaintops and hold on to those special times, it's the will of God that as we're strengthened in those times, we get into the flow of life again, get on with serving the Lord, come back, we might say, almost down to earth. And Jacob experienced something of that. After the wrestling with God at Peniel, there's still Esau to be faced. And so we want to look this evening at Genesis 33. And we're thinking the theme, two paths diverge. Two paths diverge. And see, first of all, the meeting can't be put off any longer. Jacob, as we thought earlier, could have avoided it, but he realizes Esau has got to be faced. He's got to deal with now 20 years of, could well be, of Esau's anger and bitterness. He doesn't know what's waiting for him. And you see first there the preparations that Jacob is making. Esau, 400 men are approaching. It could be an extremely dangerous situation. For all Jacob knows, Esau now is going to vent 20 years of anger on his flocks, his herds, his family, on him. Perfectly possible. So he splits up the family, group by group. No doubt his thinking is that should Esau actually attack them, well, at least there's the possibility some will escape. Isn't it striking the order in which he places them? Tells us something very significant. Right at the back, we might expect the safest of all, Rachel and Joseph at the rear. Still clear after all these years where his affections really lie. You wonder how the others felt about that. Maybe they'd come to the point where they didn't expect anything else. But it may well be that Jacob thought the covenant promise would run through Joseph. He might well have concluded that, that Joseph would be the next step in the unfolding of God's plan. We know, of course, that wasn't to be the case. It was Judah who would be the next step, and it would be through Judah that the line of promise would run. But Jacob at this point may well have thought Joseph is the one. And so special care and attention were given to him. Jacob goes out in front. And we've got to recognize he takes the first risk in meeting Esau. Bowed to the ground 7 times. He humbles himself before Esau, his brother. And it's hard not to see in Jacob bowing before Esau an ironic reversal of the promise of blessing that had been given to Jacob by Isaac. Back in chapter 27, if you look at the blessing that Isaac had given Jacob, part of it was that nations would bow down to Jacob. And yet here's Jacob now bowing down before Esau. And of course, all that he's doing is designed to heal the breach with Esau. Avoiding, I suppose we would have to say, rubbing in the situation, the reversal that had taken place in God's purpose. And with Jacob carefully avoiding making a point of it at this stage. And we'd have to say there is wisdom in what he's doing. He makes the preparations. But then the encounter inevitably comes, and it doesn't go at all in the way that Jacob probably feared. He must have expected at least expressions of anger, some desire for revenge. Esau's had 20 years to sit and go over the grievances. And yet that's not how it happened. Esau embraced him, he threw his arms round his neck and kissed him, and they wept. It is a very emotional reunion. And to all appearances, and we've no reason to doubt appearances here, Esau is not holding any grudge against Jacob. In fact, he shows a forgiving spirit. We're not to conclude from this that Esau now is a spiritually minded man. There's no evidence of that. But it does remind us of something we encounter in life, that sometimes those without the grace of God, the saving grace of God, can put believers to shame by the way they deal with others. Don't we sadly sometimes see God's people harsh and condemning and judgmental and proud? And we see those who make no profession of faith can be kind and gentle and helpful people. That's what we call the common grace of God. It's God restraining the expression of sin. It's not that these people are saved. But there are evidences of God restraining and holding back the sinfulness of their nature. And they do sometimes put believers to shame. We've all probably encountered that from time to time. Here for Esau, there's no sign of him recalling those years of grievance. He seems to have put them behind him. He's moved on. And there does seem to be a genuine reconciliation between the two brothers. There's a tremendous emotion. And in the Eastern culture, it would be more easy for them to express it openly and obviously. As they embrace each other, as they weep, there is a real reconciliation. In the past, deception and all that went with that are now put away. And put away, it seems, for good. It probably smooths the path for Esau that materially he's got on well. He says, verse 9, I already have plenty. And so in that sense, there's no need for jealousy of what Jacob has, a desire for it. Esau, in the material way, is well provided for. And from everything we have seen of Esau earlier in Genesis, that'll satisfy him. He never gave any real appearance of valuing spiritual things. The whole issue of selling the birthright indicated a man who was wrapped up in this world and in the material things of life. And so if he has plenty materially, he'll be content. And that really is how Esau appears to be living his life. And yet we do see something surely deeper at work here. Do we not see again God's hand in all of this? Jacob's fears and the possibilities for danger, for even disaster. But God continues to work out his purpose, even through Jacob in his weaknesses and his failings. God's promise runs through Jacob, on down eventually to Christ. And the Lord is making sure that the covenant seed is kept safe. God makes sure that Jacob and his family are secure, because God has a purpose for these people. And so though they may go through hard times, as we'll see, God willing, next week, there are some spiritually very low times, still the purpose works out. And he keeps Jacob and his family safe. God's plan can't be derailed. And this is the God, as Paul puts it in Ephesians 3:20, who's able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine. And surely this is one example where God does immeasurably more than Jacob could have asked or imagined. The plan of God is working out. He preserves the covenant seed. And so they meet, and Jacob offers a present, huge present to Esau. Finally, it's accepted by Esau. And it's a little difficult as you read their exchange to be sure whether this is simply the Eastern way of doing things. And perhaps Esau always intended to take the present. And it might well have been a snub to Jacob if he hadn't taken it. We don't know. But eventually Esau accepts the present. And it does fulfill important purposes. Initially, of course, in Jacob's mind, the point was to secure Esau's favor. Verse 8, to find favor in your eyes. That was the first thing, naturally, that Jacob was thinking of. But now, of course, that's not necessary. Esau is favorable. He doesn't need the present. But the other words that are used here are significant. Verse 10 is referred to as a gift. And the word that's used is the idea of thanksgiving. And so it expresses Jacob's gratitude for the welcome he has received. it almost is a kind of thank offering to Esau for the welcome that's given. It's a gift. And in verse 11, it's a present. Literally, it's a blessing. That's the word that's used. So the gift that Jacob gives to Esau is described as a blessing. That's an odd word, perhaps, to use. Why is it described in that way? Well, surely it's Jacob sharing some of the fruit of the blessing of God that he's experienced himself. And isn't that part, of course, of the covenant promise that blessing will come through the seed of Abraham? And here, again, in a small way, we might say, blessing comes through the seed of Abraham, Jacob in this case. So again, there are foreshadowings of the outworking of God's plan. And we know, of course, the fulfillment of the plan is the blessing that comes through Christ, the seed of Abraham. These are little tokens, little foreshadowings of even greater, more wonderful things still to come in God's purpose. And you wonder, perhaps in Jacob's mind, as he says in verse 11, God has been gracious. Is there an awareness of his own sin in the past? I think there probably is. Yet God's been gracious to him. There was the deception. There was all the chicanery and the maneuvering to get the blessing. And now, from the perspective of 20 years later, he sees God's been gracious. And he's experienced that grace himself in his own life. So it is a very striking meeting that takes place, so different from what Jacob might have expected, so different from what Jacob had any right to expect. And yet God overrules, and God protects, and God's still working out his purpose through the line of Abraham, imperfect, sinful, and yet God's chosen people. We should never lose the sense of wonder. I think that God works through people like this. God works through people like us, imperfect, to fulfill his purpose. The meeting. But then secondly, we have to see here the separation. The separation. Esau appears to assume Jacob and the whole company will come with him back to Seir. It's going to be a big family reunion. Everybody's going to be together. Let us be on our way. I'll accompany you. And in Esau's mind, that's how it's going to work out. They'll all be together once more. Probably not permanently, but for a time. Jacob responds that it wouldn't be practical for his whole company, including the children, to travel along with Esau and his men. Jacob will have to travel slowly. There are all sorts of practical limitations. Animals with young. He couldn't keep up with Esau and his men. Let my Lord go on ahead, says Jacob. He even declines an escort of Esau's men, verse 15. No, he'll go by himself. And at one level, it seems perfectly reasonable and practical. Let's look a little more closely at what exactly is happening here. Verse 14, Jacob talks in terms of going to Seir with Esau until I come to my Lord in Seir. So Esau goes off, thinks Jacob's coming along. But then verse 17, Jacob went to Succoth. Now if get a Bible atlas and check the geography. Instead of turning east to follow Esau to Seir, Jacob actually turns north and almost goes in the opposite direction. And it becomes clear that Jacob never had any intention of going along with Esau back to Seir. So we have to ask, well, why did he do that? How are we to understand what's going on here? Is Jacob just being difficult? What's happening? He gives the impression he's going with Esau. In fact, he immediately heads off in the opposite direction. Surely at least one element, we trust that the most significant element in what's happening is Jacob now understands that there can't be any true spiritual unity with godless Esau. In fact, too close an association with Esau could well prove harmful for Jacob's family. Esau is a man who has no regard for God or the things of God. And that would not be a good environment to bring his young family into. And Jacob understands that. For all that there's been reconciliation, Jacob and Esau are still fundamentally different men. Jacob, for all his weaknesses, is still a man of God. Esau, for all the common grace we've seen in him, is still godless Esau. And so there cannot be a real mixing of the two. Certainly Jacob will continue good relations with Esau. But he knows there is a spiritual distinctiveness that he has to maintain. And he cannot allow that to be diluted. He goes off to Seir, and his family start to mix with Esau and Esau's family, and just the whole environment. It will not be spiritually helpful. And so at this point, the two paths have to diverge. Jacob can't go along with Esau. He can't go literally. But the fundamental reason is he can't go spiritually. And they do have to separate. And it is a reminder that the people of God are called to a distinctive life directed by God and God's word. It doesn't mean that we don't seek the best relations with unbelievers that we can possibly have. And sometimes Christians are very poor at doing that. We should seek good relations, but we never must blur the fact that spiritually speaking, God calls us to be distinct in a humble way and as a result of God's grace, not in self-righteousness, not because we think we're better than others, but because God has called us to a different life. As Paul asks, in 2 Corinthians 6:14, for what do righteousness and wickedness have in common? Or what fellowship can light have with darkness? And we've got, honestly, before God to say we cannot have fellowship with those who are in spiritual darkness. We trust we can have good relations, friendship. But there's always a spiritual distinction. And we've got faithfully to maintain it. So that surely is at the root of Jacob separating from Esau. But I think too we have to recognize that Jacob surely should have been open about what he was doing. There is an element of the covert, a little of the old deceiver, perhaps showing through once again. Was Jacob afraid of the consequences of openness? He didn't trust God to oversee if he honestly said that he wasn't going with Esau. May well be. Maybe it seemed easier just to keep quiet and let Esau go. And when he was out of sight, head off in the opposite direction. And I don't think it was a commendable action on his part. He ought to have done what he did, but done it in an open way. And God's people are called to stand openly for their commitment to the Lord. Think of Nicodemus, the secret disciple, didn't want others to know. Eventually, of course, he had to come into the open. But sometimes it seems easier to keep our heads down, not really be God's witnesses, not explain why we live the way we do, avoid the difficult situations in family and work, wherever it is. Of course, we need grace to do it in the right spirit and the right way, so that we aren't those who appear self-righteous and proud of ourselves. And yet there needs to be an openness in our life and our witness before the world. And the fear of man does pressure us to compromise. It'll pressure Jacob again in the following chapter. And we do experience the pressures. What will people think? What will they say? And yet, ultimately, we have to ask whose opinion is most valuable to us. Is it what the Lord thinks of us or what others think of us? We can see others. We can see their expression. We can hear their words. But it's the Lord's view of us, surely, that must be most important. So Jacob is right in making the separation. There can't be an ongoing unity, and certainly not a spiritual unity with Esau. But there's something unworthy in the way he deals with it, and an element of the covert when he should have been open and taken an opportunity to speak for why he lived the way he did. Many opportunities for witness do we lose because we're afraid of what people will say or think of us. The meeting, the separation, and finally the arrival. The arrival. He arrives, we're told, eventually in peace. He goes via Succoth, and then he comes to the city of Shechem in Canaan, verse 18. He arrived safely. And now, finally, after 20 years, he's back in Canaan. Only just, but he is back in Canaan, the land of promise. And that expression, he arrived safely, or he arrived in peace, is significant. Because if you go back to his vow at Bethel, when he was leaving 20 years before, back in chapter 28, and his vow included the words that God would enable him to return safely to his father's house. And now he returns safely to the land of promise. It's surely no accident that the same expression is used. God has been faithful to Jacob through all those events of those years, his good times and his bad times, his times of blessedness, his times of decline. But God has been faithful, and God has brought him back into the land. He's not yet at his final destination, and we'll see he does delay, and there are problems because of the delay. He ought to be getting on and getting to Bethel, but he takes his time unduly. But still, God has brought him this far. And Jacob now must respond appropriately. God has proved himself faithful. He had said 20 years ago, "The Lord will be my God." And you see something of that commitment now on Jacob's part. He buys a piece of ground, verse 19. Why does he do that? It's not simply a matter of convenience or a matter of economics. I think it is a token of his faith, that this is the land of promise, and as Abraham years before in chapter 23 had bought the burial plot, token of faith that this land was the land God would give them, now Jacob buys a piece of the ground near Shechem. He possesses a little part of Canaan. He'll not possess it all, not in his day. But this is the land of promise. And Jacob does believe the promise. This is the land God will give his seed. And Jacob does have a small possession in the land. That's part of what he does. Then he builds an altar. That's a pattern you see, of course, among the patriarchs. In those special places and special times, an altar is built. There, verse 20, he set up an altar and he gives it a name. Abraham had done it. Isaac had done it. A reminder of God's blessing. It's not that there was only one particular place where God could be worshipped. Of course not. But it was a way of remembering. It was a visible token. And the name that he gives to it, we're told at the very end of the chapter, El Elohe Israel. which probably means, "Mighty is the God of Israel." And you see the significance of that. Mighty is the God of Israel. Who is this God of Israel? He's the one who has brought Israel, brought Jacob, back from wandering in Haran, back into the land of promise that God has said he will give to Jacob's seed, generation after generation. How will the promise be fulfilled? It will be by the might of God. God who will keep the promise on track despite man's sin, despite circumstances, despite every effort of Satan to destroy the Israelites. Because that's what much of the history books are about. Satan trying to destroy the Israelites. But he won't succeed. And God will keep his promise, the promise that leads us to Christ and to our salvation. God will make sure that promise is fulfilled. Mighty is the God of Israel. Jacob recognizes that. And he makes the visible token in the altar. And he remembers. He's there because mighty is the God of Israel. The promises will be fulfilled because mighty is the God of Israel. Christ has provided salvation for sinners because mighty is the God of Israel. And we are saved. And we have an eternal hope because mighty is the God of Israel. Jacob's God is our God. It's the same purpose that's being worked out. We'll see Jacob in glory. And it's all by God's power and God's grace that unworthy sinners, the Jacobs, and the people like us will receive such a glorious inheritance. Mighty is the God of Israel, and all the praise and glory for salvation belong to him. May our hope and our confidence be in the God of Israel, God of grace. He takes unworthy sinners and makes them his children and works out his purposes through us for his glory.